keen.
They were as young as 14. Nearly 250,000 answered the call to arms in the First World War.
But on leaving these shores, the boys were expected to fight and suffer like men, engulfed by the horror of the greatest conflict the world had ever known. This is the story of five teenage Tommies. There was a tin miner son from Cornwall, the son of a Lancashire vicar, a blacksmith's apprentice from across the border in Yorkshire, a Jewish boy from London's East End, and the shy son of a factory owner who gave up his chance to escape the war.
They had in common their youth and their innocence of war.
More than 20,000 teenage Tommies were killed. Many more were badly wounded. And for others who came home, the horror of war would live with them until the end of their lives.
My father told me all sorts of stories. In the hour or two before he died, he was on the Western Front yelling, "Bosch are coming. We're going over the top now." Right down deep on the ground floor of his memory was the Western Front.
Empty bullet casings falling. BBC Teenage Tommies. A newspaper headline: England for War, orders to the fleet.
When war was declared on the 4th of August 1914, Britain had a standing army of 250,000 men, facing a German army three times that size.
Richard Van Emden.
The Secretary of State for War, Lord Kitchener, needs a new civilian army. So he immediately sets out to say, "I need 100,000 men straight away." And he puts out his appeal in August 1914, and he is immediately swamped, not by 100,000, but with 1.1 million volunteers.
A poster of a queue of men entitled "Step Into Your Place."
Amid the patriotic fervour, rules were ignored. Soldiers were supposed to be 19 to fight, but many younger boys wanted to join up. Such was the need for volunteers that recruitment officers were often willing to sign up even the most fresh-faced boys.
It was obvious they weren't 19, but you have a queue of men going down the road, you're getting a bounty for everyone who joins up. Are you really going to argue the toss with a young lad who's enthusiastic, who's keen as mustard to go, who looks maybe pretty fit, pretty well? Let's take him.
A photo of a young lad being measured up.
One of the volunteers was 14-year-old St. John Battersby.
St. John Battersby was born in 1900. He was brought up here in Holy Trinity Parish in Blakely, on the outskirts of Manchester. In fact, his father was the first vicar of this parish.
He ran away from home just after the outbreak of the war because his mother had died and he wanted to go into the army. His father was horrified. Not that he had joined the army, but that he had joined it as an ordinary soldier. His father clearly felt his son should be in the army as a leader.
Commensurate with his father's social position.
Yes.
And his father, of course, intervenes. And we know that because there is a reference here seeking support from the mayor of Manchester.
And the headmaster of Middleton Grammar School. And they both say this boy would make an excellent officer. Little white lie along the way.
It succeeded. The 14-year-old was commissioned as a second lieutenant in one of the new PALS battalions, designed to boost recruitment by keeping it local.
Remember, if you can get 15, 30 or 60 of your comrades to join, you can all enlist together, train and fight together.
A view over the rooftops of Leeds.
It must have seemed the jolliest of ideas to combine patriotism and friendship on a big adventure in Europe. A boy did what his mates did. He joined up. One such boy was a 14-year-old blacksmith's apprentice who came here to Woodhouse Moor in Leeds to enlist.
A photo of Horace Irons, aged 14.
One of the reasons why he joined was that he was handed a white feather on the trams, which was quite a prevalent practice, particularly from mothers and grandmothers whose children, boys, had joined up.
So it was like, suggesting he was a coward?
Well, that was a suggestion.
I mean, he was only 14.
Yeah.
What do you say? I'm too young, I couldn't fight. And then later he's up here on the moor, joining up.
Yes.
Horace and his fellow Leeds pals were sent for battle training to Costerdale, a camp on the Yorkshire Dales.
For men working in the factories, it would have been quite an idyllic experience. 3 square meals, lots of fresh air and exercise. To improve their physical fitness, they would have started with route marches and drills, and eventually they would have started training with the various weapons.
Now, it wasn't all training, because I can see here we have a photograph of a rugby match that took place up here. And here is your great-granduncle.
Really?
There he is.
Wow.
I think he looks like you.
He looks a lot more grown up than he does with his uniform on. He does look like a fully grown man, though.
This is your first time visiting this place, and I'm just wondering what you make of it.
It would be quite similar to one of my cadet camps, with orders and training and things going wrong all the time. For me, it's just fun, but for him, it would have just been preparation for war. There would have been a sense of danger looming ahead.
Horace Isle's great-grandnephew, William.
Recruiters were sent to all corners of the British Isles in a great national campaign. In the shadow of the redundant Cornish tin mines, one 15-year-old found the promise of adventure overseas hard to resist. Cyril Jose, the son of an out-of-work miner, followed the call to arms.
Fergal's with Cyril's granddaughter, Pauline Wallace.
No certainty of work anymore, and poverty in this area. War might have seemed like an escape to him.
Well, he was very young, of course, so I don't know that he would have thought about it quite in the same way. It was certainly an adventure, and you can read that in his letters.
Dearest Ivy, stand back. I've got my own rifle and bayonet. The bayonet's about 2 feet long from hilt to end of point. Must feel a bit rummy to run into one of them in a charge. Not arf. Goodbye and God bless you. From your affect brother, Cyril.
Going to war at the age of 16. He'd quite a bit of responsibility, didn't he?
Well, I think that's right, but there's also a lot of childhood still in him. I mean, a lot of the letters from Grandpa, he was asking for copies of The Magnet. And he was clearly still playing tricks and acting like a child. So there's a bit of a mixture of both, I think.
It would take a lot to put a British Tommy off his football. Here, a German shell exploded right on the field of play. To show their contempt for the enemy's fire, they continued their game.
An excerpt from The Magnet Library, Volume 9, Number 381.
But you didn't have to be native-born British to feel the powerful pull of patriotism during the First World War. Here in London's East End, a haven for migrants back then, as it is now, a 15-year-old boy was longing to join up.
A.B. Bevenstein was born in Russian-occupied Poland in 1898 and came to London with his parents when he was 3.
The whole street, everybody knew each other and just surrounded by our own kind, which were all Jewish people. The grocer, the baker, everybody within walking distance of the house, all Jewish.
From what you know, did A.B. have a strong desire to assimilate?
Whether he wanted to or not, at this board school, he would have been taught in English. He probably belonged to a Jewish club, and there the emphasis was not so much on Jewishness, but on a sort of military form of Englishness. Discipline, hard physical exercise and being proudly British.
And joining up in 1914 is part of this process.
And it's going a step further, that it's actually showing your loyalty by potentially giving your life for your new country.
In September 1914, A.B. Bevenstein volunteered, changing his name to the British Harris.
Film of soldiers marching.
Dear Mother, I did not like to leave you on Tuesday. I was very sorry to see you cry. But never mind. I will come home one day. From your loving son, A.B.
I'm sure he regretted joining up in the army without their knowledge. They were heartbroken because of the religion and because they were Orthodox. It's something the only son would not do. They would want him to become, I don't know, whatever, but certainly...
A soldier was not a thing you did.
A soldier was not the thing that you would do.
Just a mile from where A.B. lived, another boy from a very different background was also preparing for war.
Ernest Steele, Queen's Westminster Rifles, aged 17.
Ernest Steele was a child of the new middle classes. His father had built up a thriving box-making business in Hackney, where Ernest went to work, aged 15.
It wouldn't have been unusual for a 15-year-old boy to be working in a factory here then.
No, not at all. I mean, it's very typical of the middle classes that he had a very decent education, but then left when he was 15 and started working in his father's business.
I knew that there was cardboard boxes, but I've never seen these sort of pictures, so I'm quite surprised at that. And I never got a sense of the scale or that they were actually doing quite well for themselves.
Probably the most remarkable comparison.
Military collector David Epson has found a trove of material on Ernest's life.
I've been a custodian of part of your family's history. This is him leaving school as a 14 or 15-year-old. This is the house he was born and grew up in and from which he entered the army in 1914.
That's fantastic.
There he is as a young teenager, obviously, just joined the army.
So young.
So young. And this is actually Ernest's own little photograph album. His father, Edwin, yeah.
Photos from the album. A football team, a couple staring at the camera, three women smiling. Ernest's great-grandniece, Emma Sutton, shakes her head.
That is his past and his history. Even his handwriting.
She folds up a letter.
His bow is in here. His fiancée.
Engaged to.
Oh, yes. The Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam. E.C. Steele. Why on earth you would have this in the trenches in the First World War?
Scholars have nothing to teach you. From the soft touch of the eyelashes of a woman, you will know all there is to know about happiness.
Soldiers on a boat leaving port.
On the 17th of August 1915, Ernest Steele was sent with his regiment, the Queen's Westminster Rifles, to Le Havre in France, and then on to Ypres in Belgium.
Dear Mater and Pater, since I last wrote, lots of things have happened. Left England for France, arrived Havre 12 midnight, rose at 7, parade in afternoon.
In Ernest's own diary, he reveals how he was given an extraordinary chance to escape the war.
August 17th, 1915. Light duty. Sergeant Clifford told all under 19 years of age could go back to England if they wished. After long discussion, we decided to stay.
That shows a real commitment to his comrades and to the people he was out there with. He was given a kind of opt-out, wasn't he, to come back to being a cardboard box manufacturer's son and living, but decided that they couldn't desert the other people who were already out there.
The White Cliffs of Dover.
In 1915 and 1916, nearly 600,000 volunteers joined the war.
Among them were our five teenage Tommies. While Ernest Steele was engaged in Ypres, A.B. Bevenstein, the Jewish EastEnder, was further south, where the battle for Loos was raging. That too was the destination for the Cornish miner's son, Cyril Jose. 15-year-old officer St. John Battersby from Manchester and Horace Isles, the Leeds blacksmith's apprentice, arrived near Serre in the Somme region. Some of the trenches where Horace Isles was stationed have been preserved.
It's so hard to visualise what it would have been like for a 16-year-old to arrive into these trenches in the middle of the carnage.
Even before you arrive in this frontline trench, you're going to be passing behind you the cemeteries in their great numbers. The dead stacked behind this trench, ready to be taken away. And you may look out into no man's land and see the dead men already out there. The stench of these trenches, the smell of the cordite, the rumbling guns. The whole of your body would move with that rumbling, even though you're not on the receiving end of it. Suddenly it'll be your turn.
Rod Bedford, Royal British Legion. A photograph of dead soldiers in the trenches.
What would the attitude have been to the more seasoned soldiers, the veterans, to a youngster like Horace arriving in this trench?
Poor Horace. You're going to have to earn your spurs. You will be tested. But if we were in this trench now, for instance, going over the top, who's going to be back over that trench first towards the enemy? Do you think it would be the old soldier, or do you think it's going to be the young soldier? Which one would you send?
As a tactical point of view, I'd send the young soldier, purely because you don't want to waste your best men.
In fact, it's going to be the old soldier. The old soldier will say to the youngster, "Follow me, my lad, I'll see you through it." If I'm the first up that assault ladder, the machine gun hasn't yet started to strafe the trench. If I'm going up the third or fourth man up that trench, the machine guns are now tapping into these sandbags, and I could cop it in the chest or the head.
A reconstruction of soldiers leaving the trench.
And you know who's going to go and get it, don't you? It's going to be the 16-year-old, isn't it?
On the 22nd of May, Horace Isles had his first taste of the terror of warfare when the Germans raided his trench.
The Germans were very, very keen on trench raiding, which meant sending small groups of men out to get into the frontline trenches. Using a rifle in a trench would be very difficult, so that's why they were using knives and clubs to bludgeon the enemy there. It's at that point you realise, can I do this? Can I kill another man? And you are facing that man. It was either kill or be killed.
After fierce fighting, the Leeds pals repelled the invaders, but at a cost. 15 dead, 34 wounded, an officer shell-shocked. Horace was lightly wounded. After being patched up, he was sent back to the front line.
Dear Flory, I was discharged from hospital 2 days ago. It's 3 weeks since I've had a letter. Hope you and the Nipper are in the pink. Your loving brother, Horace.
By the spring of 1915, the teenage Tommies knew the kind of war they were facing. In one major battle around Ypres in Belgium, there were 60,000 British casualties. In August, the 16-year-old tin miner's son from Cornwall, Cyril Jose, was sent here to Fromelles, near Lille.
A photo of a smiling Cyril.
Now he and the other men of the 2nd Battalion Devonshire Regiment were preparing to go into battle. You've never been to where Cyril served. On the Western Front.
I've never had any idea where it was.
But you're about to find out exactly where, because this technology takes the old trench maps and, using GPS, takes us where Cyril and his comrades were serving. And you can see
here are the British lines. This area in between here is no man's land, and there you have the German lines. Cyril is already taking part in attacks in no man's land at night.
A pale moon behind clouds at night.
The trenches come alive at night. Men would be working to repair the trenches that had been destroyed by shell fire. So they may actually go on working parties out into no man's land to improve the wire.
I've been quite adventurous for the past 2 nights, having been out in front with a covering party while some others fixed up some barbed wire. The first night was quite exciting, as the G's must have spotted something once or twice, as they sent over a lot of rapid fire.
A reconstruction of a young soldier, illuminated as he lies in a trench.
They continually sent up star shells, so they had to keep our nappers down low.
Star shells would linger in the air and illuminate as it fell. They had to remain stock still. If there was any movement, the snipers on the other side would pick them off.
Soldiers moving in darkness.
I then rejoined my section, and on sentry, I didn't have to send some ammunition over to our old friend Fritzy.
One of the things about Cyril's letters is he says how exciting it is to go over the top. Others with a sense of self-preservation would stay back.
And this arrow is taking us in the direction of where there was a listening post. It's as far forward as you're going to put your own men,
right,
as they listen, literally, for any movement of the enemy.
I had a rotten experience next to last night in the trenches when I went out into a listening post about 75 yards out. So they must have known something was there. The G's had a rifle fixed so as to hit the listening post. And it was a bit quiet. One chap bobbed up. Got it through the napper. He died soon after. Guess I didn't bob up so much after that.
You can imagine how he must have felt.
Yes.
And he's just seen a man shot through the head.
It must have been very close to him too.
His granddaughter shakes her head.
How he survived, I shall never understand.
It's one of those things in war that you can be an incredibly experienced soldier and get shot in the head, and you can be a 16-year-old on your first trip to an observation post and you can survive.
Yeah.
It's chance a lot of the time. But maybe he was a lucky boy, Sarah.
I think that's probably a fair assessment of my grandfather, actually.
A pen and ink drawing of officers in a shelter.
Although one hears much about the flooded trenches of Belgium, knee-deep mud is not always the case. Our cheerful Tommies managed to construct these cosy shelters for a well-earned rest. Our artist depicts a typical scene.
In fact, trench warfare had become stalemated. New tactics were needed. One of the most frightening was tunnelling under the trenches and planting mines.
What it meant to the infantry was they were constantly fearful that there was going to be an explosion under their feet. And particularly in the region around Luz, where there was a lot of tunnelling activity on both sides.
Film of a mine exploding.
The 16-year-old East Ender, A.B. Bevenstein, faced the threat of mines in the fighting around Loos.
Dear Mother, I've been in the trenches 4 times and come out safe. We go in the trenches for 6 days and then we get relief for 6 days' rest. Dear Mother, I do not like the trenches. We are going in again this week.
On the 29th of December 1915, the Germans and their lines over there had tunnelled here under Princes Street Trench, where A.B. Harris and his comrades were stationed.
A reconstruction of the mine exploding.
Two men were killed and Abe was wounded.
Dear mother, well, I was taken ill and I was sent to the hospital. But don't get upset about it. I will be all right.
Sir, I regret to inform you that Private Abraham Harris is ill, suffering from wounds and shock.
What they mean by shock is he's suffering from damage that cannot be accounted for by physical impacts on his body. Shell shock was the term that was used for soldiers who would become, in effect, militarily worthless. They might understand it in common terms as temporary madness.
Dear mother, you don't know how I was longing for a letter from you. I would like to know what the War Office said was the matter with me.
Most doctors thought that it was a collapse of morale or a character defect. You're damaged goods.
Early in the new year of 1916, Private A.B. Harris was still on the Western Front, billeted in this farmhouse at La Flandrie. He'd been injured and shell-shocked, but he was past fit for duty. 16-year-old A.B. Harris was about to go into action once more.
Film of a mine exploding.
Very few people's nerves will stand even the prospect of a second big explosion. If one wants to look at it like drawing a check on the account of courage or fortitude that Abby had got, that would have been a mighty big check. That would have really emptied the account.
A reconstruction of soldiers in the trenches.
AB arrived back in the trenches here near Vermel on the 12th of February 1916. Within a matter of hours, fighting had broken out. Grenades exploded around him. He was deafened and suffering from shock.
Debris rains down and a bird flies away.
AB Harris left his trench and found his way to the company headquarters. After examination by a medical officer, he was pronounced fit for duty and ordered to return to the front line.
Cobwebs hanging from barbed wire.
Baby set off in the opposite direction.
A field stretches out to the misty horizon.
Further north, in Belgium, the other London boy, Ernest Steele, the factory owner's son from Hackney, was among the thousands of men brought in to reinforce units that had suffered severe casualties. Ernest arrived at the front in August 1915. By then, any optimism about a swift victory had vanished. The swelling casualty lists brought home the awful reality of modern warfare. For Ernest, any movement out of his trench could mean death.
Tuesday, December 14th, 1915. In evening, went up to firing line. Got over near Hooge when mine went up, and then overcame umpteen shells and rapid fire. I fell over a dead man. I got hit slightly. I'm feeling rocky. Wrist hurting slightly and nerves going. Iodine for wrist and rum for nerves.
He's being shot at and people are falling around him. And he's only a young boy, isn't he? I think it's quite shocking.
We also know war is taking a deep strain on him from a letter that he sends back to his brother.
Dear Harry, I heard from Maita last night and she said you wanted to join up. Now, I'm going to talk to you seriously, so look out. You may feel old and strong, but you're only 15. Therefore, you're too young to stand the strain of anything approaching this. I'm over 3 years older than you, and even I'm beginning to think I'm not much use out here. Love to all. From your elder brother, who knows?
He wants him to be alive when he goes back. Maybe that's something that he's looking forward to, is going back and seeing his family and his brother. You have to have that hope and optimism when you're in war that you are going to go home.
30 miles to the south, near Béthune in northern France, The other young Londoner, A.B. Bevenstein, now known as Private Harris, had wandered shell-shocked away from the front line. He went back to the farmhouse where he'd been earlier billeted. In the army's eyes, he was now a deserter.
Dear Mother, we were in the trenches and I was ill, so I went out. And they took me to the prison. And I'm in a bit of trouble now.
A.B. was brought before a court-martial. He wasn't a worldly wise boy. Despite facing senior military officers, he decided to defend himself.
Abby comes in, he's faced with four officers, so he's in a room full of people who he's been educated to defer to, and he's undefended.
A copy of the plea sheet with not guilty written in ink and the typed phrase, offence charged.
Desertion means not being in your appointed place. If you've left when an enemy attack is in progress, wow, you've got some explaining to do. If you don't run very far, you're a coward. If you run a fair distance, you're a deserter.
The phrase deserting His Majesty's service.
In case of desertion, you have to prove intent. The court, as far as it's concerned, once they've heard Cordillon, the French woman, her evidence is absolutely crucial.
I recognised him as he had been billeted at the farm for 3 weeks. He said the Germans had been bombing our trench and he had left them and was going to England.
The moment that she says he wants to get back to England, that's it, that's intent. There is no corroboration for it. It wouldn't stand up in a regular civil court. The court makes its decision, guilty. Sentenced to death. It's over, done and dusted within 15 minutes, half an hour tops.
A faint ray of light through thick clouds.
Army law's not about justice. Army law's about discipline.
A reconstruction of the firing squad.
This was sent to your grandparents. I wonder, would you mind just reading it to me?
Private Harris was sentenced after trial by a court-martial to suffer death by being shot for desertion, and the sentence was duly executed on 20th of March, 1916.
I am, sir, your obedient servant, P.G. Hindley.
I can't imagine what my grandparents and my mother must have felt on receiving something like this, just to be told that your son has been shot for desertion. Must have bewildered them.
AB's death warrant.
That wasn't justice. Had it been an officer with shell shock, I'm quite sure they would have sent him back to England to go to hospital.
Of the 306 soldiers executed during World War I for military offences, only two were officers. But young officers made up a disproportionate share of battle casualties. They were often the first to be targeted by the enemy. We have very little understanding of what it was like to be an officer, and particularly a junior officer. These were men who had to lead from the front. They were men who were distinguishable by dress. So every time an officer went out, they would be in danger. Therefore, the casualty rates amongst junior officers was the highest. These men were difficult to replace. And so you have this incredible situation where you might have a 16-year-old in charge of men in their 30s, even 40s.
One such 16-year-old leading his men was the Manchester vicar's son, St. John Battersby. He arrived in France with his locally recruited battalion, the Accrington Pals, in the spring of 1916. The Pals were joining in a massive build-up of troops along a 15-mile stretch of the British line in the area of the Somme.
So they were put on a train, and Deet describes how this train eventually
came to the end of the line in the middle of a field, surrounded by ammunition boxes. There's my dad, 16 years old, really in the war. He is responsible for 30-odd men. His decisions may result in them dying or not dying.
St. John Battersby was now among 600,000 British troops gathering for the biggest and hopefully decisive offensive of the war. In fact, all four surviving teenage Tommies were converging on the Somme. Londoner Ernest Steele was in Gommecourt. The Cornish miner's son, Cyril Jose, was sent to La Boisselle. And joining St. John Battersby at Serre was blacksmith's apprentice Horace Isles of the Leeds Pals.
We've now arrived at the exact position of the Leeds Pals. What would it have looked like on the morning of the 1st of July, their position?
Well, as you said, we're on the exact position and the line's going straight in the line with my arm towards the top of that coppice because they're going to be heading in this direction, looking towards those German positions.
And there's been 7 days of continuous bombardment leading up to this.
7 days, the greatest barrage the world had ever seen. And this was to kill, concuss and cave in the German trenches and to render them incapable of any form of resistance.
But for Horace, for your relative, it's good news, this pounding.
No one would have believed that anything could have survived. I mean, he was hit by a barrage himself, wounded, so he knew what the damage it could do.
The illustration depicts one of our batteries in action. The range of the enemy is found by a means of wonderful calculations.
What they've been told by their officers, that those Germans out there have actually been sent senseless by this 7-day barrage. There'll be no Germans out there ready to fight against you. We're going to walk all the way to Berlin.
Black and white film of cannons being fired and explosions.
The advance was planned for the 1st of July.
The field today.
The day began with mist, and the final Allied bombardment got underway. A British officer wrote of how the air vibrated and the earth shook.
Across a 16-mile front, 120,000 men got ready to go over the top.
Fergal walks away across the field.
What happened next would become the bloodiest story in the British Army's history.
Hands holding onto a machine gun and spent bullet cartridges falling into a pile. Then a black and white photo of soldiers going over the top.
There are photographs of men who rose out of the trenches in the Battle of the Somme and who were felled by this very rapid rate of fire, knocked down by a barrage of machine gun bullets. The intention, of course, of the Somme was that those machine guns wouldn't be there. They would be destroyed by the artillery.
A photo of a soldier lying dead.
But the Germans survived by digging deep. The British suffered almost 60,000 casualties amid the constant machine gun fire.
A photograph of St. John Battersby in his uniform cap.
Waiting to face the machine guns was the youngest officer at the Somme, 16-year-old St. John Battersby.
My father said he came out of the trench and was advancing down the hill with machine gun fire coming from his right. He said he could see the fire sweeping the field, he could see men falling before him, and just as the machine gun arrived and hit him, it jammed and stopped firing. He took a number of bullets in the hip and one that went straight through the forearm.
A 16-year-old can see the machine gun fire coming towards him and he keeps walking towards it.
Yeah.
It's hard to conceive of that.
In slow motion, the bullets pass through the machine gun, their casings falling into a pile. Anthony Battersby, St. John Battersby's son.
When you look at the figures for the wounded and the casualties, out of the battalion, 87 confirmed killed, but then 335 missing. And you realise that the vast majority of the battalion just simply disappeared.
The wide expanse of flat field.
This land is just full of dead people to this day.
The furrowed brown earth today.
At the same time on that fateful day, 20 miles away, the tin miner's son, Cyril Jose, was preparing for battle.
All across the line, men were clambering out of their trenches into the withering fire of the Germans. 16-year-old Cyril Jose from Cornwall was with the Devonshire Regiment, attacking the village of Ovillers-la-Boisselle. They had to cross a quarter of a mile of no man's land, ground that sloped upwards towards the German positions.
Men went down like corn before a scythe. Down went 2nd Lieutenant Gould. Across him fell his batman, Harry Hamblin. Both were killed instantly. A bullet thumped through my left shoulder and chest, knocking me down. I panicked and yelled, "I'm hit!" Not until 7 a.m. on the 2nd of July, stiff and in pain, did I feel it safe to move. Slowly, I began the long crawl back. It seemed that I was alone in a field of dead men.
It was only when we read the letters that we really began to understand what it must have been like for him.
Because after he's wounded, it takes him 2 days
yes.
to crawl through no man's land, back, all the way back to the British lines. And he describes himself, his uniform purple with blood. I mean, it took a lot of strength to do that.
And I think also he talks about drinking water out of the bottles from dead men's bodies. And for a 17-year-old to do that, it's just truly scary. I mean, can't imagine how the emotions he must have been going through as he was trying to get back to his trench.
Cobwebs glistening with dew hang suspended between plants.
Some big bug thought it a great idea to go over in broad daylight instead of crawling up as near their parapet in the night. Of course, Johnny wouldn't expect us then so much. What brains old Douglas must have. Made me laugh when I read his dispatch. I attacked. Old women in England picturing Sir Doug in front of the British waves, brandishing his sword at Johnny in the trenches.
Attack Johnny from 100 miles back. I'll get a job like that in the next war. That is so much my grandfather. It's exactly the way he used to talk about the generals and the way in which he felt that they'd just been thrown like lambs to the slaughter without any kind of thought about what it must be like for the men on the front line. This is a boy who, 18 months earlier, had enlisted at the age of 15, presumably very enthusiastic about what he was going in for, and then to come to that sort of reaction. Sorry, that letter always makes me choke up.
Among the few to reach the German trenches was Ernest Steele's regiment, but success was short-lived.
Regiment reached the German line, but owing to division on right failing, we had to retire with enormous casualties. Out of 3,000, only 600 got back. Division covered in glory and gore.
Row upon row of white headstones.
The slaughter on the Somme marked a critical moment in the story of the boy soldiers. As news of casualties emerged, parents began to question why their children were at the front. They began to campaign, lobbying the press and politicians to bring the boys home.
Horace Isle's family in Leeds was now deeply concerned about their 16-year-old boy.
Horace's sister, Flurry, writes him a letter. You actually have a copy of that letter?
Yeah. "My dear Horace, I am so glad you are all right so far, but I need not tell you, What an anxious time I am having on your account.
We did hear that they were fetching all back from France under 19. For goodness sake, Horace, tell them how old you are. I'm sure they will send you back if they know you are only 16. If you don't do it now, you will come back in bits and we want the whole of you. Just remember, I am always thinking of you and hoping for your safe return.
Your loving sister, Florrie. The problem with it, though, is by the time it got sent over there, he was already dead. So she was returned. She was sent back the unopened letter with just "killed in action" written at the top. My great-great-uncle Horace, somewhere in that field. I mean, I've read somewhere that he was left out there for a year.
Horace's great-grandnephew William walks through the cemetery, past rows of uniform white headstones gleaming in the sunlight. Horace's headstone amidst a row of his comrades.
Under growing public pressure, the army withdrew the underage soldiers from the battlefield to special camps until they reached their 19th birthdays. But not all were happy with this.
They rioted. Every window in the place was shattered. Everything breakable was smashed into small bits. One of the guards fled to a small room and locked himself in.
These lads, they've been in action. A lot of them had military medals. As far as they're concerned, they are bigger than these chaps who have authority over them. They're not going to be chivvied to go and clean their barrack rooms. They're not going to run 20 miles. They're going to do exactly what they want to do.
Cyril Jose from Cornwall was recovering from wounds at his camp.
How did Cyril acclimatise to life in the camps himself?
By the time he was wounded on the 1st of July, I think he was probably pretty glad to get out of it, at least for a while. He would have known that while the war continued, his age was getting to the point when he was going to go back overseas. So that may have been of some concern to him, you know, having seen the action he had. But he was willing to go and he went back.
There must have been guys dreading their birthday.
There are cases where young lads have slit their own throats. I think his name's McConnell of the 16th Highland Light Infantry cuts his own throat because he's hit 19 and he just cannot face it again. And that's the tragedy. That's the great tragedy. But then that's one small tragedy when there were thousands happening just, you know, 30 miles away.
But not all underage soldiers were sent to the camps. The shortage of experienced leaders caused by the high casualty rate meant that teenaged officers could stay and fight if they and their parents agreed. 3 months after he was shot on the Somme, 16-year-old St. John Battersby was back on the front line. He was barely 2 miles from where he'd been wounded.
He's under a bridge across the trench, and a shell landed on top of it. One was killed outright. One had both his legs blown off. My father had his left leg seriously damaged, probably by something like that. That on its own would sever a leg. 4 weeks later, he had the leg amputated.
To Secretary War Office. Sir, I am in receipt of your letter informing me that there is no alternative but to relinquish my commission owing to ill health. As I am only an amputation case, I could do almost any home service duties. I would wish to remain in until the end of the war, if possible. Your obedient servant, R. St. John Battersby.
He'd stayed in until September 1920.
By September 1918, only two of our teenage Tommies were still at war, and both were converging on the battlefield of Epuhy in northern France. Cyril Jose from Cornwall, now 19, was back in the trenches from his camp and getting ready for the final Allied push. Ernest Steele, the son of the London factory owner, was now a lieutenant in one of the mobile machine gun units, coming into their own as the stalemate in the trenches was broken. The boy, who'd been offered a ticket home back in 1915, had seen the war through to its final phase.
Ernest knows the Allies now have the momentum. After 3 years here, after turning down the chance to leave, after becoming a leader and a man, Ernest can glimpse the end, the promise of home. On the 17th, Ernest is here, and these are the Allied trenches right next to the railway line. And as he's looking out across the fields, he can see the German line, which they're going to assault the following day. And on that evening, Ernest writes a letter home.
Dear Mater and Pater, as I don't suppose I shall have a chance of writing you again for a few days, I thought I'd take the chance of letting you know, so that you shouldn't worry. I think we're winning the war hand over fist now, and I hope to be home for good in less than a year. While I'm out here, I realise more than ever all that you have done for me, and I wish I could have the chance to repay you at least a part. The best of love from your affectionate son, Ernest.
From film of the sky being illuminated by gunfire to silhouetted corn crops swaying in the breeze.
Early on the morning of September the 18th, Ernest and his machine gunners move forward ahead of the main group of troops. The German lines are all across here, and Ernest and his men, they're setting up their machine gun positions so they're going to be able to lay down fire for the infantry as they move forward. Covered by machine gun fire, Cornish boy Cyril Jose was emerging from the trenches.
We advanced 3,000 yards to put the pincers around St. Quentin.
A photo of a pile of bodies in a trench.
We took plenty of prisoners. Quite a change for me to be in such an easy stunt. Jerry put up good resistance. I got hit. Still, must be thankful for small mercies.
Although Cyril Jose was once again wounded, the Battle of Epuhi was a success. The two-mile advance yielded thousands of prisoners. But the Allies suffered over 1,200 casualties.
Ernest and his men come into the view of the German troops. Just as they reach this point here, at the top of the hill, here at this point, Ernest is hit by a German sniper, and he's killed instantly.
His great-grandniece Emma looks emotional. Now red poppies amidst long grass, and a small flock of birds flying above. Ernest's white gravestone, then Emma laying a poppy on the spot where he fell.
It's a sad ending, but I guess a lot of the men who came out had this ending. And not the returning home and telling my Mater and Pater all about it that they'd hoped.
Ernest's father, Edwin, the boxmaker from Hackney, created his own memorial to his son.
Inside a wooden box, an album entitled In Glorious Memory.
Edwin never got over the death of his son. He was heartbroken at the loss of the bright shining light in the family he had all these hopes and dreams for. I don't think he ever looked at the world in the same way again.
The Battle of Epuhi saw the end of Cyril Jose's war. His wound gave him a ticket home to England. But his war experiences led him to mistrust authority for the rest of his life.
It explains an awful lot of his attitude towards the establishment, towards authority. He never really wanted to be part of that establishment.
So there he is.
That's him. He was a jolly person. He was always laughing. He lived in a caravan in Epping Forest for a long time. He'd just do whatever he had to do for money. I mean, that was it. As long as he had money for his books, that was all he cared about.
A photo of him with his family as an elderly man.
The vicar's son, St. John Battersby, who lost his leg in the war, himself became a vicar of a small rural parish.
He was a very thoughtful man, playful. He didn't drive. He would walk up and down this hill to visit the people in the village. He wanted to have somewhere that was safe and calm and assured. If you spent 3 years not knowing whether you would be alive in the next 15 seconds or not, being assured that that was going to be the case here would be good news.
The war haunted the families of the dead. Like 17-year-old Jewish boy A.B. Bevenstein, executed for desertion.
My mother never spoke about him, but I do recall, though, when November the 11th used to come around each year, that she would go into the dining room, close the doors, and have a really good sob. I regret very much not having gone in and asked her why. It brought back memories of the brother that she lost to the world.
AB's headstone. Now a view of the fields from above.
Horace Isle's great-grandnephew, just 16 himself, has come to visit his grave for the first time.
Slowly he walks over to his great-granduncle's gravestone amidst a row of identical white headstones.
For Horace and all the Leeds pals, may you all rest in peace, knowing you're not forgotten and have our gratitude. From four Leeds pals, Phil, Dave, Steve, Rick.
Rest in peace.
William touches the headstone, then walks away.
The thing that sent me off was the wreath of poppies. It was a letter written on it from four servicemen. They'd just written to all who died here with our friends that you have our ever-serving gratitude.
He stops and glances back.
I'm happy for who he was. I'm grateful for what he did. And that's all I really can do.
He wipes away a tear, then walks on with Fergal.
The horror of total war changed the lives of thousands of teenage soldiers. For the dead and the survivors, what was lost here was youth and all its hopes.